Arno T. Lenz in Sherwood Hills, Madison, Wisconsin, and we're conducting an interview on his career in the Department of Civil Engineering. Professor Lenz, perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about your background, where you were born, your education.
Well, I was born in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, on September 22, 1906. My father was a machinist with the Giddings and Lewis Machine Tool Company up there for 60 years. And I bring that in because of my continued association with the University of Wisconsin. I did teach here as an instructor through professor and department chairman, a total of 46 years. So it's rather traditional that the Lenzes stay in one job, I guess. My father wanted me to be a mechanical engineer. And my mother, my being the only child, would have liked if I became a math teacher at Fond du Lac High School and stayed up there. But I had ideas that I wanted to go into something that included a little bit more outdoor work. And in high school, I read Dr. Van Hise's book on the conservation of natural resources, and I became interested in the natural resources of our country. And as I recall, he had something in about building dams, and that intrigued me. I think I might have become an architect if the university had a school of architecture here on the Madison campus, but it didn't, and so I was also interested in structures, and that being a part of civil engineering, I naturally gravitated to that. I had a high school teacher who was very helpful in shaping my career toward mathematics and engineering. And her name was Mrs. Decker. I came down as a freshman.
What year was this?
In 1924. University had about 8,000 students, more or less, and it was a small campus, and by present standards, I lived in a rooming house for 2 years, and then dormitories were built, Tripp and Adams Hall. So I was in Tripp Hall the first year it was in operation, and stayed there for 2 years until I graduated in 1928. After
can we go back to
sure
I want to ask
sure.
a few questions about
sure
never talked to anyone who was in Tripp right when it started before, so tell me a little bit about your experiences at Tripp. Was it
I enjoyed them very much. The we had single rooms, and we had house fellows. Mm-hmm. In fact, in one of the years that I was there, the house fellow was Norman Neal, who lives out here in Shorewood. I think he's here in the winter time. And if you're interested in the dormitories in those days, well, you might like to talk with him.
What did you see as the response, as the job of the hospital?
As I saw it, he just more or less was there as an advisor to students. We, of course, in those days didn't have a drinking problem. The dormitories were a very settled operation. You get a bunch of students together, and they make a little noise once in a while, but it was, compared to the way I've heard things are more recently, it was a pretty steady operation, and there wasn't very much hell raising or anything of that sort.
So you might go to the house fellow with problems about classes or professors or personal problems or any sort of problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Could you describe what meals were like, mealtime, let's say dinner time, big meal, evening meal?
We would, the bell would ring, and we'd go over. I think my wife
would. That was on cue, by the way. The bell would ring and the phone rang.
Let's see, where were we?
We were talking about dinner. The bell would
ring. The bell would ring. We would go over generally with a group of our friends and go to one of the big tables. They had long tables. I don't know how it is now. And sit down, and the food would be served to us. The food was good. It, I was well satisfied.
Who was your cook, do you remember?
Well, I think Carson Gully.
Carson Gully,
yeah, I think so.
Noted figure.
Yes, yes.
Dorm history.
Right.
Did you, what dress did you wear when you went to dinner?
When it was cool, jackets and sweaters and things. The sort of dress that you'd wear going to class.
So would that be a little more formal than students do today?
I think probably, yes.
Okay. Do you remember, did the house fellow partake of dinner, and did he engage in conversation with you or anything like that?
As I recall, he did. I don't remember that as being a real continuous thing that he would be with us. But there were, 35 men in the house, more or less. And, I suppose he might go on to another.
What about prayers before dinner?
None to my recollection.
Going to your classes now, you're an engineering major.
Right,
civil engineering.
Could
you talk just a little bit about your undergraduate experience in terms of which professors influenced you the most or inspired you the most?
Yes. There were several. Dean Millar, you may have run across, was associate dean and had charge of freshman advising, I'd say. Although there were separate freshman advisors for smaller groups, but he was in charge of it. And he also taught descriptive geometry. was a, really a very fine man.
How would you rate him as a teacher?
Very good. I had him for a class. I was fortunate. And I had him for the class in descriptive geometry.
That's the Adam Millar.
That's right. I think that was just a temporary thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
He was getting toward retirement himself, as I recall. Then Ray Owen taught surveying, and surveying was taken in the freshman and sophomore years primarily, and he was kind of an unofficial advisor to us. We would go to him with our problems too. Then things developed, I got to know Danny Mead, who was really one of the pillars of the civil engineering department. It wasn't a department at that time, mm-hmm. as you know. I got to know Lenny Smith in Highways pretty well. Through Chi Epsilon to some extent. Chi Epsilon, you know, is a civil engineering honor fraternity. And that was very helpful. I went in as a junior, and incidentally, in the same class, Kurt Wendt was also initiated.
Now, you said it was rather helpful. Why was Chi Epsilon?
Well, I got to know faculty better. The faculty would come to the meetings, and I got to know them a little better that way.
Would they talk to the group about different things, or why would they
talk? Yes, yeah, they would talk to the group, and we would just be able to meet informally rather than formal classroom.
Did the other departments, major courses of study, like mechanical engineering and electrical engineering, did they have their own honor fraternities?
Yes. Pi Tau Sigma, I guess, in mechanical engineering.
And they had similar types of functions.
Similar operations, right.
How were you elected into that?
You had to have a certain a grade point average, generally a B average, although in Chi Epsilon it was definitely a B plus average. The national fraternity and our chapter is number 6 in the National Fraternity.
Does that mean it's the sixth one?
Sixth one founded, yeah. In fact, the fraternity was founded at the University of Illinois only some 2-3 years before our chapter.
So you were elected into it on the basis of a grade point?
Yes, but elected by the students. In fact, there were some students who were way high as far as grade point average was concerned who did not get elected. So it wasn't only for scholarship.
Did you have a house or a building or a location?
No. It's against the fraternity rules to have any.
So you would
house.
Just call a meeting in a building?
That's right. We met in university buildings, and then, of course, after the union was built, well, then we would meet at the union sometimes.
Did you ever have any encounters with law students? Were you in a
I've
heard some great stories about the law school.
We had a fellow, this came a little bit later, but a fellow who was working down at the hydraulic lab where my office was. And his name was Sam Kotz. He's out in Omaha now, I think. But we went over to the law school. I wasn't involved, but I heard about it later. They went over and got a log chain and put it through the door handles, front door in the law building. And they, Sam put a lead link in it. So it looked like a welded chain. The lawyers couldn't get in the building. They pulled on it, and of course it didn't do any good. And fiddled around with it, and finally Sam stalked across, and he just knew where to grab hold of it. He bent over it, and he just pulled, you know. And the link came apart. That brings up the St. Pat's parades. So you probably heard about those.
Wisconsin Engineer.
That's right. That's right. And they had, I remember one time they had a truck, flatbed truck. I guess maybe it was a trailer. And we were doing some research on toilet bowl design at that time, and they put a half a dozen of these toilet bowls on the truck and stuffed some dummies head first down in, and they had some kind of a sign about the law school on that, the Great Flush or something.
Was there ever any myth as to why the rivalry developed between the two, friendly rivalry, developed between the two schools? Was it simply location?
I think location had an awful lot to do with it. It didn't, there wasn't, I never heard of it. You know, real knockdown, drag out fight or anything.
Okay, we are now having you graduate from the university. 1928
mm-hmm.
or 9?
That's right, 28.
Stepping back one half step here, you have down here, how much emphasis was on the theoretical and how much on the practical in your undergraduate training?
A lot on the practical. Theory, of course, mathematical theory, as well as practical mathematics. We didn't have calculators, say nothing of computers. And, excuse me, this is Mrs. Landis.
Okay, we were talking about the theoretical versus the
practical. Practical was stressed pretty much, certainly in comparison to modern day.
And we'll get into more of that a little bit later.
All right.
Now we come to your graduation and your subsequent career at UW.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, I got a job through Ray Owen on construction up at Nakusa, Wisconsin, just south of Wisconsin Rapids. With the Nakusa Edwards Paper Company. And I expected to start a career, at least, with on construction.
Would that your job be surveying, or what was it?
Inspection, that is, as a construction inspector, more or less. The job was being run by the company itself, and one of the things I remember, we put in some steel window frames, and I found out that openings tilted, and we had the frames in wrong, so that the when we tilted the window, the top of the window came outside, and if it rained, well, the rain would come down and come into the building, so we had to turn those around. So bottom tilted out, and the top was on the inside. That kind of thing. Along about in the middle of the summer, I got a call. And, of course, being dumped up in Coosa after 4 years on a college campus, it was pretty lonely up there. I got a call. They were looking for an instructor. Mrs. Kessler tells the story that a decision was made out in her kitchen that her husband, Professor Louis Kessler, and Bob Homewood, an instructor, they were looking for some help. They were the hydraulic and sanitary department. Frank Dawson was coming as the full professor to be in charge of the laboratory. But he hadn't come yet, and he didn't know any of our students, former students, anyway. So they were running down the list of students, and I guess they started at the top scholastically, at least. And the story goes that Betty said, well, what's the matter with Arnold? Nobody could think of anything that was the matter with Arnold. So they said, all right, we'll call him. So they called me to the, I got the call in the office phone. We had a little construction office in the shack out on the job. And they wanted to know if I'd be interested. Well, I was interested for one thing. I wasn't real happy up there with the social life and the whole living conditions. As a student, we had three, as an undergraduate, we had three elective courses in the whole curriculum. I took one with Danny Mead in hydraulics, and a course called Hydrological Investigations, and I enjoyed that very much. And then I took a course with Dean Trenor in Advanced Structures, and my third course, the last semester, I took with Dean Trenor, and I think that was called Indeterminate Structures. Danny Mead had a second course, too, that I wanted to take in hydraulic design. So this looked like a good opportunity to get back to the campus and take that course. It would be right in the same department. And maybe if I decided to stay on, you like me, why I'd go on and get a master's degree. Well, in those days, I think there was only one, possibly two fellowships, the whole College of Engineering. It was almost impossible to get one of those. The hydraulic and sanitary group had one year before, maybe a couple years before, and they had a man who, I don't know whether he ever did any teaching here or not, I don't think so, but he got a PhD, and they had hired him then to stay on to teach, but he got a job offer from either Tulane or LSU. I think it was probably LSU. And they offered him $50 more than the University of Wisconsin was paying. That's $50 a year more. He decided to take the job. So it may have been that he took the job at the University of Illinois, but that was an Illinois offer. And that later, he ended up his career at Illinois. So. But anyway, he went there. And that left the opening. And it sounded good, and so I came down.
Did you come down with thought that it would be a one-year position or a continuing position?
Well, they didn't tell me anything. I thought that the way conditions were, probably it would be a year or two. When I got... I did get my master's degree then, I think that was 1932. I was teaching full time and teaching courses in hydraulics, and then I was helping Danny Mead in these various courses. He was part he was part time, and. He taught 4 hours in a row every morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I think one of those days, Wednesday probably, was Monday, Wednesday course. That was his part-time schedule, but he gave the lectures, and I graded the papers, and I made up the examinations from my lecture notes that I took, and his books. He had written books I like down in the videos. One of them was in contracts and specifications, incidentally. And I never really realized that that was considered a department at any time, but it was. But that was 31 or 32, I can look it up exactly. But in those days, this was the depth of the Depression. I remember sitting in Frank Dawson. This we'll look back on as the depth of the Depression. So there weren't very many jobs around. Engineers were selling insurance and doing all sorts of work. Some of the boys never did get into engineering. And I say boys because there weren't any girls. Mm-hmm. The only girl you probably never heard was in my So I stayed on. Sometime along in there, I had an offer from the Bureau of Reclamation to go out on construction. Rose Irrigation Project in the state of Washington. And I almost took it, but by that time I was I began working toward a PhD. Frank Dawson was a co-author of a book, Schroeder and Dawson, a book on hydraulics. And he was interested in research on oil flow over triangular weirs. there be notches and the water or oil flows over them. And if you know the dimensions of the notch and the height of the liquid behind, well, you can figure out what the flow is. So there's a surface tension effect and viscosity effect in there. And I started on that for my master's thesis. But it was kind of intriguing, so this was something that I could continue on if I stayed here. And I did, and eventually got a PhD thesis on it.
Now, on that whole thing on master's and PhDs,
yeah.
This was something that was evolving in engineering, the higher degrees?
Yes, yes. I think Glenn Cox, this man I was telling about, who was going to work for us and then left to go to Illinois, I think his was the first PhD in the civil engineering area, at least in the hydraulic and sanitary area. PhDs were a little more common in such things as chemical engineering, for example. You can see that in relation to chemistry and the long tradition there. But in engineering, at least in civil engineering, there just were no PhDs. Dawson didn't have any. His co-author, Dr. Schroeder from Cornell, I think, did have one. And Dawson urged me to go on and get one.
So that was my next question. How did the people who did not have them, like Dawson, I don't think you had one, think most of those people had any.
No.
How did they feel about this in general, about this new trend? Did they support it, or did they?
Yes. That is, at least Frank Dawson did. And Kessler did not have one. Mm-hmm. But Dawson supported it, and I never ran across anybody who was against the idea of a PhD. Danny Mead did urge practical experience for engineering teachers. And all through those years, I was out. I went back to Nacoosa Edwards each summer for several summers after I came back down here to teach. We had a 9-month appointment with 10 checks. Unless you had some kind of a job during the summer, well, it was a little bit rough going. Salaries weren't that high. This was a fairly common thing if you could get, that is, in the civil engineering area, at least. Cottingham worked at Forest Products Laboratory, for example. There were some work for consulting engineers.
Now, getting back to the PhDs and advanced degree, how do you see this in retrospect as having changed engineering, if indeed it changed it at all?
Well, I think it has. There has evolved a program in engineering technology, which we do not have on our campus, but many campuses do. And the engineering technologists is, in general, as I see it, a more practical man than perhaps the graduate who gets his degree in engineering. Well, let's see.
Yes, sir. What about the difference, the evolving degrees, emphasis on degrees? Did this slam things more toward the theoretical?
Well, I think it did. Not that the civil engineer now isn't able to handle practical work, but the whole field has expanded so, and it's necessary for an engineer to be able to handle more advanced mathematics. Those who are in sanitary engineering, for example, and sometimes it's called environmental engineering, although there's nothing wrong with the word sanitary, in my opinion, and those men have to have a much broader foundation in chemistry, for example. So as our knowledge has expanded, I think theoretical knowledge is more important.
And, maybe
and if one is going to teach, and if one is going to write engineering papers, why they have to be theoretically sound, practically sound. In fact, I was editor of the Chi Epsilon newsletter, or I shouldn't say it that way. The National Society has a magazine that's put out several times a year called The Transit. And it contains news of chapters and all that. And then a few articles that have some, engineering value to them in the sense that they report on what's going on. And, of course, the engineering periodicals do, too. And in letters to the editor, there was, from the engineers in the field, they would write and say that they thought that the articles were too scientific, not practical enough. And I wrote quite a letter on that as my opinion of it. And I suggested that the ideal way would be to have two co-authors, one a practical man and one an academic who had more of a scientific background, and for those two to work together to put out an article that could well be understood by the practicing engineer. And at the same time, it would have enough scientific need in it so it would be worthwhile. And that stopped the letters coming for a while.
Okay, let's get down to some of the specifics on your career.
All right.
What about your teaching interests over your career at UW?
Well, gradually, as I was taking my graduate work, I needed a minor outside of my field. My field was in hydraulics, and the PhD was in this what is now called fluid mechanics rather than hydraulics. I started in with a minor in mathematics, and took several courses, but these would be sandwiched in between my teaching duties. And as I got deeper and deeper into the courses. I finally got into a course in the complex variable. And it just got too complex for me. So I quit for a while. In fact, I almost quit going on for the degree. And again, Frank Dawson, who was department chairman at that time, Mead had, Mead never really acted as a chairman. I don't think he ever called it a department meeting. It was kind of an honorary chairmanship, and Dawson was a man who did the operations, hired people, and assigned teaching duties and so on. Frank Dawson said, you've just got to keep on going so far. So I started, I kind of sounded around. By that time, I was very much interested in hydrology and the study of water resources. And this goes way back to Manfred's book, I guess. But I taught that course in hydraulics then, or in hydrology, and I got interested in geology. So I went over. I had known Dr. Twentwolf somewhere or other. Anyway, I got talking with him, and he suggested I take a minor in geology. And so I took his course in sedimentation. I took a course in glacial geology. And several other courses. I also took a course with economics, public utility economics, and that was with Martin Glazier. So I had some good teachers. In that course, I did not have the prerequisite to the prerequisite, but from my engineering experience, I got along. Handled all right. In the geology, I had a good partner in a sedimentation lab. We had to look at some slides, and I couldn't see much in them. It was like looking 2 inches away from a plastered wall or something, as far as I was concerned. But my partner was a real good geologist, and I could write reports. So the two of us together put together some good reports, and he did all right in the course. But I finally ended up with a minor then in geology with some of the other. So I finally got my degree, and went on. Now, I don't know whether I've answered your question. I seem to be drifting.
Well, on. That's okay. That was an important, actually, that was a background to what the next three questions will be.
All right.
And that's essentially your teaching, research, and service. It was the old Wisconsin idea that
that's
Heinz
right.
talked about.
That's right.
Tell me what your major teaching responsibilities were in the department.
Well, back in those days, I was teaching the course in hydraulics.
Is that the introductory course?
The introductory course. Yeah. After Danny Mead retired, we had a Jim Bowman from this was again during the Depression years. He had been in charge of the office of Harza Engineering Company down in Chicago, very famous and large operation. They had done a lot of work for the Insul utility empire. I don't know whether you ever heard of that or not, but in those days it was big. Frank Dawson got Jim Bowman here to take over Danny Mead's lectures. When TVA got started, TVA hired Jim Bowman to come down and do much of the work that he had been doing for Harza. Those responsibilities fell on my shoulders, so that by that time, I guess they thought I was ready for it, I taught water power engineering, hydraulic machinery, that time it was called drainage and irrigation. I don't think we taught the country. Course in hydrological investigations, hydraulic design. I guess that's about enough.
Yeah, so
it was a broad cross section of the courses in the water area.
And many of the courses that Danny Mead had taught.
That's right.
One little question about Danny Mead before we go to the research interest. You said that he was half time at university. Where was
he? Had a consulting practice at the other half. In fact, he used to tell how he took his university salary, which I think was $450 a month, which was fabulous to us. And that was his part-time salary. And he said he turned that over to Mrs. Mead to rent the house.
Okay, now we're getting into your research interest.
Yeah.
You talked about your PhD already. So.
That's right. As I took over these professional courses, let's call them, in the water area, I got interested in hydrological investigations, largely. Jim Bowman had me come down to TVA for several summers. I'm putting several summers down there in the hydrological area. We located rain gauges up in the Smoky Mountains to get records. For TVA. One of those are still in operation. We did some flood forecasting for the construction of Norris Dam. The river was pinched in, so it had to go through a narrow flume while they were building the foundations for the rest of the dam. That intrigued me, so I came back and I started some thesis students. We had undergraduate theses as well as some master's theses here. and later on. And I got interested in flood forecasting and did some work in that. And I wrote a couple of papers here and there. Along about that time, built a flume down in the hydraulics lab. I built it and designed it. And it was the only structural design I ever did. Down the hydraulics lab, and we ran some model tests there for the construction of Peatonwell and Castlerock dams up here on the Wisconsin River. That was done in conjunction with the Harza Engineering Company. They revitalized Harza in Chicago. And incidentally, one of my master's students went to work for them and is now the, I think he's president. And we also ran model tests on Dubé Dam. They had some foundation problems, and we ran some model tests for them on that. That's up on the Wisconsin River. They were in model testing. And that is, my research was in model testing, and then in the investigative work in connection with rainfall and runoff.
You said that you had a minor in geology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever do any corroborative research with geology or any other department and/or teaching?
Well, not in this connection. That was good background for my understanding the rain falls, when it runs off, and it's a function of the underlying geology, of course. Collaboration, you might say, came in. Henry Hart, I don't know, do you know Henry Hart? From political science. Henry got interested in water resources, and he came into my office one day and asked if I'd be interested in working with him in a seminar on water resources management. And it sounded interesting to me, so kept going. In fact, I think we may have had one of the first programs of that sort in the country. Harvard started a water resources management program a year or two after we got ours going. Ours gradually developed, and developed into a full-fledged program for a master's degree in water resources management. And we got some federal support, and I think they're still going.
Yeah. And you did this with Hart?
With Hart, yeah.
You continued to work.
Henry and I started it, and we thought we ought to have somebody from economics, so we drew in Martin Glazier, and he was with us only a few years before he retired. Then we After he retired, Fred Klarenbach took over Glazer's interests, and Fred was in the program, I guess, until he retired. But this really is after after the World War II period, where you want to,
we're emphasizing that early stuff. But
sure,
but you know, anything that comes up like this, of course, the interview.
Someplace, if you have it in the files, it may be useful.
It'll be useful when I get to this other.
Right, part. Right.
What about service to state industry?
These model tests were paid for by Consolidated Water, Power, and Paper Company up there at Wisconsin Rapids.
Was this something that was service to the state?
But you mean in the nature of public service?
Yeah, I'm going out and talking to industry, and rather than being hired as
consultants. Yeah.
Is this something that was emphasized in, or talked about at all, or was it just expected to come up in the course of events?
Well, it came up more or less in the course of events. One thing we did was work with the Wisconsin Valley Improvement Company. They operate a series of reservoirs on the Wisconsin River and tributaries. And we did a lot of undergraduate thesis work. They would provide us with the records. And the students would work on them. And then they would get the reports back, and there was no money involved in that. This was a real public service type operation.
Did you ever have people from industry just call you up and say, "Please, Professor Lenz, I've really got a problem here. This doesn't seem to be working right in the floods and irrigation system. Could you take a look at it or anything like that?" That kind of thing.
Well, not too much. I'm trying to think. I think we had a call. I think this is how it got started. And there was a little manufacturing company up near Chilton, that area. And they were building a hydraulic ram. We did some testing. I think that came in originally as a call. But it was, not
so
normal.
It would be the exception rather than the rule.
Right.
We're going to go into some other areas in career. You talked about Danny Mead's, what sounds like incredibly low, $450 a month, for certainly one of the stars of the university at that
right.
point. How were salary increases determined? Let's talk about the early years now, about 25.
When I was an instructor, I can't tell you how they were determined. We would just find out about it. Sometimes we wouldn't even find out about it until the fall. We would get the first check. When I was department chairman, I think one of the first things I did once the salary was determined, I wrote letters to each of our faculty and told them what the salary for the next year was going to be.
Now, you said once the salary was determined.
Yeah.
Did you make that determination, or your executive?
Initially, when I was first department chairman, I would call in. That is, from the dean's office, we got a letter saying how much we had available for salary increases. And then I would take a look at what salaries were and how they compared for different men in the department, what they had been doing, how much teaching they were doing, and how much other things they were doing, writing and public service and all this sort of thing. And then I would get the group together lay out what my ideas were as to how these salaries were to be allocated. A base amount was on a percentage basis. But then in the second or third column, why there would be a couple hundred dollars here or there and so on. I'd point that out. And that worked for a while, a couple years. And then two of my professors got real angry with each other because each one thought the other one was getting too much. And so I quit that so far as getting the group together. I gave them the numbers, and they could fight it out with me if they wanted to, but I wasn't going to have them fighting each other over it. So that's about the way it went. And one of our associate professors, I guess he was, went over to the University of Hawaii, and they were talking about salaries there. And he cited the way I did it, and apparently they were doing it pretty arbitrarily, and nobody knew what was going on. He liked the way I was doing it, and he was telling them about it. Later, toward the end of my term as chairman, it developed into more of a group operation, determining. I would give them some figures, but the group would hash it out more as a group. And of course, I had to justify my figures to the dean all the time.
Now, who was the dean when you were?
Dean Wendt.
How would he react generally to that?
Generally, he reacted all right. He would make a suggestion. He would raise questions, of course, about this and that. But he generally reacted favorably.
Turning the clock way back to the early 30s, do you remember the salary waivers?
Yes, I do.
Could you tell me about that, how that affected you?
Well, had notice that there were going to be salary waivers, written notice, that there were going to be salary waivers. And these were supposed to be waivers, and eventually we were supposed to get them back. Well, once things got a little bit better, I was an instructor then, and the instructors got their waivers back in the sense that shortly after the waivers terminated, we got back to the level that we were before waivers were started. But we never got any back pay or anything of that sort. And I think at the higher levels, professors, for example, it was a long, long time before they ever got back to their pre-salary.
So in a sense, instructors made out a little bit better.
Yes, relatively better.
Do you remember you or your colleagues' reaction to waivers when they came about?
Well, there was no serious reaction. Jobs were so darn scarce that if you didn't like it, you could quit, but there wasn't any job to go to. So that's the way it was.
Yeah.
We didn't have any union operations. I remember when the rush of students came back from World War II, we had thousands of students coming in. The campus just grew by leaps and bounds. I was helping the dean with registration, and this was Dean Withy, and we went up into his office, and we were comparing what the registration figures were with some of the estimates and so on. And in a joking manner, I said, you know, this would be a good time for the faculty to go on strike. He looked at me, and he pointed his finger at me, and he said, "You keep quiet." He didn't think it was funny. But there was really no talk of strikes or anything of that sort.
How were promotion and tenure decisions made earlier in your career?
I can't say real early because instructors and even assistant professors didn't have too much to say about it.
Okay,
and we weren't advised very much about that.
What about when you were an associate?
Well, later on, then of course we got into the divisions? No. Physical science division,
yeah,
and the divisions, right. That was tried on supposedly an experimental basis for a year or two. And I remember being up in a little classroom or small lecture room in the chemistry building up over the door. And we, physical science division, I don't know whether it was an executive committee or whether most, many, it was a relatively small group, I'd say maybe 35 or 40 people. And we were supposed to review the success of the division operation. And we talked a while, nobody said too much. What's the advantage of having a division? Nobody seemed to have too strong an opinion. We've got to continue this. So I moved that the division go on record as to abolishing the division activity. There were a few gasps around the room, but the motion carried. And then in the faculty meeting, physical science division was went on record that we would abolish the division. But we were the only ones. And of course, you had to have the division operation all over the whole university. And we had that. It was approved and it went on. And I think it's been a good thing. I think our difficulty in engineering was that engineers are not quite so inclined to rush out and publish their research, at least they weren't back in the early days of the division. Of course, there were not anywhere near so great a proportion of PhDs as in math and chemistry and physics and the other parts of the physical science division. So sometimes promotions to tenure have been held up. I had one case of a man I wanted very much to take over my teaching of hydrology. And there still are not too many hydrologists running around the country loose that you can grab. And I went out to a meeting at Colorado State University, and this young man from California gave a paper, and he did an excellent job, and very personable young man. And so I offered him a job, and he took it, and he came as an assistant professor. And it got up to the, pretty close to his limit without tenure. And proposed him for tenure, and he didn't have very much in the way of papers. He did have his PhD from Stanford. I tried to get tenure for him, and he didn't have enough papers, so they didn't approve him for tenure. Well, another year rolled around, and then I pounded on the table a little harder, I guess. He did get tenure, but a year later, he had an opportunity to go down to the atomic operation down at Oak Ridge. And his PhD thesis had been in relation to nuclear hydrology, if you want to call it that. So he was interested in the nuclear operations, too. So that probably entered into some extent. But he was quite disappointed when he didn't get tenure.
When you said that you were the one who made the motion to abolish the divisional committee,
mm-hmm.
Obviously part of your reason for doing that was...
Well, if there was no good reason for it, then why should we have it? We're burdened with enough committees.
Yeah. Was that the reaction of the colleagues, you think, who voted against it with you? Who stood with you?
Well, they could see my point, and I don't know whether they would have agreed, they could see my point that nobody came out strongly for the division. And if nobody wants it, then why have it?
Big question now. Around 1939 to 1940, several departments within the College of Engineering, including mm-hmm. the two that you are listed in the catalog as being at, Hydraulic and Sanitary Engineering and Engineering Contracts and specification were consolidated into the Department of Civil Engineering.
Right.
Why did this consolidation take place?
We had a new dean, Dean Johnson. You have in your records exact dates there. But Johnson wanted to have an executive committee of department chairmen. And we had all these little departments with one or two or three or four people in them. He couldn't have that whole group. And they were all in the civil engineering area. And I think that mechanical may have had two different departments. Your records perhaps show
that.
Yeah. And it was too unwieldy a group. So I don't know whether he proposed it or whether he ruled it or how it happened. Anyway, we were consolidated into a civil engineering department, and Professor Van Hagen was the senior department chairman in the small groups. So he was, I don't know whether he was elected or selected. Anyway, he became chairman of the civil engineering department.
I guess one of them, as I looked over the departments, through time, I often wondered as well why this hadn't been done earlier.
Well, because
you had courses.
There was a certain amount of professional jealousy, I guess, among these people. As a matter of fact, just the other day, one of the smaller groups, we call them divisions within civil engineering, was having a get-together. And this one wife said, our department is amazing. And she means this little group. Mm-hmm. So there was some feeling that they were departments.
Yeah, territorial.
Territorial.
Did this executive committee, this departmental chairman, actually function then under Dean Johnson?
Yes. They had their meetings, I'm quite sure. I never attended any of them.
Did that continue then under Dean Johnson?
Yes, it's continued to date.
And
that was the origin? That was the origin, yes. When I was department chairman, I went to those department chairman's meetings.
What was the reaction of you and your colleagues, if you can speak to them, on this consolidation effort by the management?
There was no objection to it so far as we at the junior level.
Question that's been
you've wondered about?
I've wondered about that. I don't have to wonder about it anymore.
Okay.
Let's first talk first for a second about what was listed in the catalog as a department, which existed from 1924, 25 through 38, 39, and that's the Engineering Contracts and Specifications Group. Could you talk about that for a second? There's no chairman listed there.
I never knew that this operation was listed as a department. That may have been primarily for budget reasons. Danny Mead taught that course as well as the various courses in hydraulic and sanitary engineering. And I helped him with contracts for a few years there. This my, as far as I know, my salary was, well, maybe it was split, but I got one check. That was all I knew about it. And Hal Roof helped him for a few years. According to this, I'd kind of forgotten that.
Now, someone like, listed here as Harold Roof,
yes,
was an instructor for 7 years. Did he then go into industry?
He was working for his PhD, and I imagine he got his PhD about 1937, mm-hmm. and he went into industry. He had made contact with Grady Foundry in Milwaukee, yes. And he was and is a very personable young man, and he moved up in the Grady organization. He was at least vice president, maybe he was higher.
Now, I noticed that you were listed as an instructor for several years when you were working on your dissertation as well. Was that a pretty
yes.
common type of
That was common.
Now,
that
why,
was common.
Why did you stay and why did Harold leave? What was
well, I think he left when after he got his PhD.
So, when you get your PhD, then you make that decision as to whether to stay.
Well,
that
was that was.
Can stay there, and whether you go off. And
that was a more or less critical time when you made decisions, and. As far as I was concerned, when I got my degree, again, this was one of those more or less critical times. I had leave of absence to go down with TVA. I had worked several summers with TVA. And I had leave of absence for a year to go on down with TVA. And I enjoyed it down there. We didn't like the climate in Knoxville as well as we liked Madison. But again, there was a situation here. One of the instructors was leaving. He had a job. Another, Louis Kessler, was assistant or associate professor. And he went to work in the Corps of Engineers as a civilian in the chief's office in Washington. And this was 1971. And there were just four in our department, that is the hydraulic and sanitary department. And it, they really needed somebody. And I wasn't that happy down at TVA. So they called me, and Dawson called me, and he said, I've got the promise of a promotion for you. You come back. That sounded kind of good. Where is this? Yeah.
The promotion then in 37-38?
Well, how does this go? No, that, yeah. I got that. Oh, and you don't have anything
well,
beyond
then,
that.
Well, then beyond that, we have civil engineering here. And that picks up where this other one stopped.
When did I get the
you went very quickly,
promotion to...
Yeah. 44, between 44 and 46.
Yeah.
And you got full professor.
Well, I guess that it was about that time that he was talking about promotion to associate professor for me. I know I didn't get it, even though I did come back. Mm-hmm. So it was a couple years after that. But I talked to the people down TVA, and they said, okay, you want to go back? Go ahead. Actually, we had a house, and we had rented the house to another man in the department, and they were very kind. They let us come back in their house, and they rented another house. Ours was furnished and everything, so it wasn't a big move for them. They would have been where we were in Sherwood. I guess that kind of cemented me into the teaching profession, because on December 7th, when Pearl Harbor came along, I don't know whether I would have been frozen down with TVA for the duration of the war, or what might have happened. If I'd stayed there that long, I probably would have stayed there.
You mentioned earlier the fact that although Meade was chairman of the Hydraulic and Sanitary Engineering Department, it was really Professor Dawson who...
Yes, he ran the department.
If you wanted something done, you would go to Dawson.
To Dawson.
Was that the general agreement
That's right, yeah.
For a few years then, there was no chairman listed, at least not in the catalog for that department. Perhaps Professor Meade continued, or Professor Dawson continued as a shadow chairman. And then Dawson was eventually chairman for at least a year in 1935-36.
Yeah, and then he left.
Then he left.
He left to become dean of engineering at the University of Iowa, Iowa City.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Then Louis Kessler, as an assistant professor, became chairman for a year.
That's right. And he was promoted then to associate professor. And that's right. And then he, when the war clouds were in the air, he left and went down with the Corps in the chief's office in Washington.
He never came back to the
National. He came back, I think it was for a year. He's shown here all during the war years as associate professor, but he was on leave for all that time. It was after the war that he came back, and then he, I think, decided he'd be more happy down at Northwestern.
Now, in 1937-38, James Woodburn joins the faculty as a full professor and as chairman of the department.
Right.
Could you tell me a little bit about him?
Jim was a very fine man. He died just a year or two ago. He was more of the more the scientist type. Am I confusing Dawson and Woodburn so far as the book was concerned? He had a book too with two men from Michigan, King and Whistler.
Who did? Woodburn?
Woodburn. And Woodburn, I guess it was when Woodburn came that I decided to continue on and get my PhD. He was strong for PhD degrees. He saw it coming.
Did he have one himself?
Yes, he had one from Michigan. His father was a history professor at Indiana University. And he grew up in Bloomington. They lived in Ann Arbor part of the time. Mrs. Woodburn can give you information on that if you need it. She lives here in Madison now. He was more the scientist type. And we got along very well together. And the Woodburns consolidated our hydraulic and sanitary group. They had us over socially. We always met on Thanksgiving Day at the Woodburns' home. They live up in the Heights near the Congregational Church up there. He was not robust physically, but everybody liked Jim Woodburn, and he did a lot for all of us.
Okay, now we have the consolidation under Dean Johnson.
Yeah.
And we go to the civil engineering department for the 18 years I've listed here.
Yeah.
You mentioned it once or twice that Leslie Van Hagen became chairman as a senior member. Until actually his departure from the university. Could you tell me a little bit about him and then why he left?
Well, I think he was 70 years old.
Oh, he retired.
He retired, yeah. I'm quite sure that he retired.
Now, as a chairman of the department for 5 years, how did he run this new department?
Pretty much a strong individual. We had a few department meetings, but not too many. Let's see, I was just trying to figure. I became associate professor, and then a couple years later, I got to be a professor under Van. And last year was tenure. We would have department meetings, and he would have an agenda worked up, and it was a pretty businesslike operation.
Did he emphasize teaching, research, anything in Ireland?
I'd say he emphasized teaching.
We're looking at the roster of civil engineering from 1940, 1942, up until only 1956-58. Let's start with Jack Borchardt.
All right. These are in alphabetical order. Jack Borchardt left the university after he got his PhD and went to the University of Michigan. Stayed there. I think he's retired now. He was in sanitary engineering.
And
Cottingham was my instructor in structures and stayed on at the university until he died. He during the war years, he was on leave and was at Forest Products Lab. Lee Crandall graduated from the university and worked at various jobs, among them on the faculty of University of Colorado, and came back from Colorado. He got his PhD at Stanford.
So and been here as associate.
Yes, until he retired a couple of years ago. Archie Easton was brought in after the war on a research project on highway safety, really. He could give you more details on that. And he left a few years ago. He's been, he had been doing some consulting work, and he's part-time and partly retired now.
Harry Felton.
Yeah. Is that Harry? I thought it was Henry. I'm pretty sure it is Henry. Left the university and to go, he was in the surveying area, and he went on the staff of the American Society for Engineering Education, and either before or after that, he's been doing teaching at a couple of different schools.
What about William Kenny?
Bill Kenny was my professor of structures, and wrote a very important collection of structural engineering reference books, known as Hoole and Kinney, and he retired. He may have died in 46, 48. Dick Kauf left us to go. Anyway, he was out in California, I think. And I think he's in Washington, D.C. right now, in some foundation or government operation. Jerry Lawton was in the water chemistry area and left us to go to the State Laboratory of Hygiene. And was there until he retired a few years ago. Bill Lee was with us a short time, and again in the water chemistry area, and went with the State Board of Health. Logan was in the hydraulics area, and I forgot where he came from, but I don't think he was real happy and left us, I guess, after a year, according to this. M. Star Nichols was away. He wrote his name and was in the State Laboratory of Hygiene, and was with us as a lecturer and a very important cog in the development, especially the chemical development of our sanitary engineering program. Ray Owen was professor of surveying for many, many years until his retirement. And in charge of our summer camp.
Now, he's the one who helped lay out the west side, didn't he?
Yes, he had quite an extensive surveying practice, and he provided jobs for many of our students, and especially during the Depression years when part-time jobs were hard to get. Lloyd Rader came to us, I think, 1 year before the war, and then was on leave as a commander in the Navy during the war years. He was in New Orleans and also at Port Hueneme, I guess it is. I don't know how you spell it. Out in California. Jerry Rolick was one of those students who came to us during the Depression years when he couldn't get a job. He had a degree from Brooklyn Polytech, and he came to us and got a second bachelor's degree from UW, and lived. Dawson arranged to have two or three students living upstairs in the hydraulic laboratory, and Jerry was one of those students. Went on for his master's and PhD degrees. Went out to Penn State University and taught for a while. Villamont was out there at the same time and can probably give you more details on that. But Jerry was one of our outstanding faculty members, known worldwide and recognized by his colleagues. He received very distinguished awards from the sanitary engineering profession. Died just this fall in Austin, Texas. He left us to go down in, it was about 1972 or 3. Went down to Austin, that is University of Texas, and had appointments in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, I think it's called, and also in the Civil Engineering Department down there.
Villamont,
you've got.
What about Wagner?
Wagner took his undergraduate work with us, as many of these did, and left us for a while to he was a reserve officer, and he was in charge of the mapping units in Africa, the African campaign also, I think, in the Italian campaign and up into France during the war. He returned to us and was in charge of the surveying camp and built up our surveying and photogrammetry operations. Woodburn came to us from the University of Washington State University is the correct title. He was a Freeman Scholar. He was on leave from Washington State and Freeman Scholar that studied in Europe. Shortly after that, came to us from Washington State. Zapata was a lecturer in the highways area, very much a part-time. I really didn't know him very well.
One or two basic questions on that.
Yeah.
We talked before about made a generalization about Van Hagen not stressing teaching and Woodburn maybe research a little more. Mm-hmm. What could a chairman do, or did either of these chairmen do anything that would make you, focus your own?
Well, not anything very really obvious, I don't think. It was more a general feeling. Van really never talked very much about research operation. Of course, we didn't have the divisional committees deciding tenure. And on the other hand, I know from my own experience that Woodburn very definitely was interested in research and research operations.
Now, you mentioned earlier internal promotion, internal hiring, like you were a student here and then an instructor. Did the department have any policy on that?
Not really, except that, again, when Woodburn was chairman, he emphasized bringing in people from outside. I think if you wanted to check now, most of our faculty, I can't say what percentage, but a pretty good percentage have outside degrees rather than Wisconsin degrees. And as chairman, I promoted that too. As an example, Cottingham would come to me whenever we needed a new person in the structures area. He would come to me and say, "Now, we've got this man getting his degree. He is just terrific. We've got to keep him." And, I would kind of sit on it a while, and we let some of those men go. They did very well. He was right. They were excellent men, but we have some excellent men too. One of those men, I guess, is still a distinguished professor at Cornell, and we have a young man, relatively young, who came to us from Ecole Polytechnique in France, which I think is good for our students to have contact with
people. So you look at more as a way of expanding the
And as we expand, that's right. Yeah.
But there was never any real issue about inbreeding or anything like that?
No, only generally. There was some talk, this man has his degree. We have degrees from Stanford and MIT, and I'd have to. It's not this group. It's the later group that came in.
And starting with Woodward, you would say that
Woodburn.
Woodburn. Yeah. There was more policy toward hiring.
Right, outside people.
But yeah. They didn't necessarily totally exclude Wisconsin.
No, no.
So it wasn't.
No. In fact, one of the divisions within civil engineering has men largely still from Wisconsin, but Wisconsin is quite preeminent in that area. And, where does Harvard go in order to get a good
fit? Well, you're most preeminent.
Right.
Do you think that was characteristic of the other major departments in the College of Engineering?
There was, I think, a drifting toward bringing in outside people. I really can't see whether that was whether it was more evident in our department or less. I really can't say.
Speaking about other departments now, we have chemical, electrical, mm-hmm. all those we were discussing.
Mm-hmm.
How did the departments relate to each other? Were there any rivalries? Were there a lot of cooperation, or were they pretty much separate entities unto themselves?
There was always cooperation if you ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
I never experienced any trouble at all. If I wanted something from another department or a faculty member from another department, we never had any trouble that way. But there was no conscious effort for the departments to try to work together, with the possible exception that in the foundations and soil mechanics area, we cooperated with the engineering mechanics department in getting the man who had a joint appointment. There's been just recently somewhat of a change in that. I think most of the work in soil mechanic, in foundations, I should say, is now in civil engineering rather than in engineering mechanics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to turn our attention now to facilities. Describe the types of facilities you had to work with when you first began as an instructor and how those changed over time.
Well, in the hydraulic and sanitary area, our facility was the laboratory down in the lakeshore. It was quite outstanding in its time. It was built in 1906, unfortunately.
Is that the one where Helen C. White now stands?
No, it's still there, down on the lake shore, right? You know where the boats are all
mm-hmm.
Along the edge there. It was entirely adequate. We had money for some new flumes. And measuring devices. In fact, one of our students who was from the Dominican Republic asked, he thought our lab was pretty good, and at the University of Santo Domingo, they were building a new laboratory. And he asked me to put together some information, some sketches of some of our equipment and so on. I told him that I thought I could do a better job if I had a chance to go down and see their lab.
Mm-hmm.
So he had some political connections, I guess, and so Trujillo paid for my expenses to go down along in February.
Good. I was going to say, I hope it wasn't winter.
And we left Madison. It was 6 degrees below zero at noon when I went around the square to pick up the tickets, the air tickets, and we were down for about a week or more, and I got back into the interior to look at a water park project that he was interested in. My wife went along. They were generous enough so that I could pay for airfare too, and we had a great time there. When Peatonwell and Castle Rock were being planned, and they needed model tests, Consolidated gave us some money, and I guess university put in part of it, and we built our flume down at the lab. We were pretty well taken care of. You've probably never heard of the time we tried to burn up Lake Mendota. Research, as I mentioned earlier, had to do with oil flow, and this oil was recirculated, of course. But any time you have oil being pumped around, why you want to spill a little here and there. So some of it got out into the lake. Down along what is now a complete walk, there were two bridges, one where we pumped the water into the lab, and the second one to the west where the water was being pumped out of the lab. And out of where the water was going out into the lake, it didn't freeze over, and there was an area about maybe a 20-foot circle or so that got covered with oil, and it wasn't very sightly, for one thing. And along in the spring, it looked as though that oil was going to spread out over the lake at one molecule thick. That would make an awful smear. So Sam Kotz, who pulled the chain on the law school, the door, suggested, I guess he or Louis Kessler or somebody, suggested that we burn it off. And we tried to light it, and we couldn't light it. And finally, Sam got the idea of soaking some waste, if you know what that is kind of stringy stuff that the machinists use for wiping up oil spills and things. He soaked it in gasoline and lit it and threw it out there. It started a fire, all right, an oil fire. And if you've seen an oil fire, it's black. And this black smoke went right straight up. Somebody turned off the water. We'd been running water in, and that wasn't quite so bad, but somebody turned off the water, and this plume of black smoke went up. Charlie Olson was assistant to E.F. Galistello, superintendent of buildings and grounds. Yeah. And he was in his office, and he looked out the window, and he saw that black plume. He told me later, he said, "There goes Bascom Hall." He almost had a heart attack going up the hill. And the fire department came down, and they just blew the fire out. They put the high-pressure hose on it, and they just blew it out and blew the oil back under the ice and put out the fire. But there was quite a bit of excitement around there for a little while.
So did you stay down there pretty much for your whole career?
No, then the College of Engineering moved from education building. You know, originally that was the engineering building. Then it became engineering education. Then they dropped the engineering and became education. And we moved over into mechanical engineering and had some offices up on the second floor. We didn't have any laboratories there. The surveying lab was still in the education building. Until the temporary buildings were built during World War II, and then they moved over into that. Now, where was I?
Okay. Well, you were in the civil
engineering building. We were in the mechanical engineering building. Oh, then the new engineering building was built. First, chemical engineering wing, and then the rest of it, as it stands. And that building is still not finished. It was supposed to be another area. They were going to have a library out in that area out in front, but now we have the Went Library. But then we moved our hydraulic lab down there and got some more new equipment. And for the kind of, certainly for instruction, I think we're adequate. And some good research has been going on down there too.
One final question on research, and that's funding for research.
Yeah.
When you, let's start to compare it throughout your career. Mm-hmm. When you decided to start up a project for research that would cost money, who would you think of turning to go?
Well, I would go to the department chairman to see what money was available, and then we went to Wharf for some support, and then we went outside. I think the model testing and the foam and all that, we really went. We got support. They more or less came to us because they wanted answers on that. Pete and Ron Castle Rock on sand foundation. Sand beds that were 200 feet deep. And these dams are built on those sand foundations, and they're patterned after a dam that Arza built down in South Carolina, the Santee Cooper project. And we had a more difficult problem because the tailwater controls the amount of erosion down below the dam. When you have released floodwaters through gates, I don't know whether you've seen a dam up close. But they have those big gates, and water is spilled out and runs down the spillway, and then it comes off the end and forms a whirlpool, really, a vertical whirl and also a horizontal whirl. And if the water comes up fast as the water is spilled from up above, why then that erosion is cut to a minimum. And the Wisconsin River is so wide that the water doesn't come up fast, so we have to do some special design. I wrote a big report on that.
So you might go to Wharf, you might be your department first of all in college engineering, then you might go to Wharf, and then you might go to industry. Was Wharf fairly receptive to civil engineering?
Reasonably so, yes. I think Wharf helped sanitary engineering probably more than it did the hydraulic area that I was involved in.
Any reason why they were on the road?
No, except that Dr. Ehrlich was a pretty good salesman, among other things.
That's the thing that matters.
Yeah, he died. Well, I guess I told you. Yeah. Just,
let's go for a minute. I'm going to skip the faculty social relationship because I hope to talk to
her right,
for a moment at the
wife.
End, and she can right. probably give me a better indication than that.
Right.
Than, as good an indication as you can.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to the deans for just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start out with Dean Fenoor, who was dean when you came as
right.
a student. And,
right.
Matter of fact, many years before you were a student. Probably almost before you were born.
In fact, I think he probably
yeah,
was.
In 1902, he began as an acting dean, and then 1903 as the dean.
Mm-hmm.
So you got him when he had been around for many, many years.
Yes.
First of all, let's just start out very briefly as with your as a student. What was your exposure to Dean as an undergraduate here?
As an undergraduate, he taught these advanced mm-hmm. courses instructors,
mm-hmm.
and. I told you, I
took
two of them. He was fairly dry as a lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a retiring man, and very solid, but not energetic in the sense that some of the others have been. One story, I don't know how true it is, but maybe it gives you a picture of the man. The story was around that when Dean Fenoor brought his budget up to the president's office, why they never cut anything from it,
mm-hmm.
and. Some thought that maybe he didn't ask for enough, but he was very conservative and very fine gentleman.
Was he rather formal or informal? How was
he? Very formal.
Now, as a student, did you ever go up and talk to him?
Not too much. After class, I might talk to him for a minute or two about some. Something to do with the lecture or her problem. So.
Now, as a young instructor, how did you obviously
no.
you have more meetings?
No. Instructors in those days they were seen but not heard too much. Mm-hmm. And that went with most of the faculty contacts, except when, of course, the men were most closely associated
mm-hmm.
with.
So you really didn't have much association with them, him then, as a,
no.
as a faculty member. By
no.
the time you were promoted, he was already gone. As the dean. Did you get any indication or any feeling about his ability to pull the College of Engineering together, or how the other members felt about his leadership capabilities?
He ran a pretty tight ship, and at the time, I think he was a good dean. I don't think he would have fit into our present day conditions.
Looking back on what you know of him and what you've been able to observe, what would you consider his successes and what would you consider his failures or his strengths or his weaknesses? Maybe that's the best
as
way
a dean.
Strengths and weaknesses as a dean.
Well, he was a distinguished scholar. I think probably that was his main strength. His weakness as a dean, well, perhaps he didn't ask for as much as he might have for the college.
Okay, next we're going to turn to Tenure left. Did he retire in 37?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And Millar?
Millar.
Millar was an acting dean for years.
Right.
We've talked about him already.
Yes.
Then F. Ellis Johnson became dean in 1938 and stayed here until 1946. Why don't you tell us, talk for a moment about him?
Well, the first contact I had with him, I remember when he was being considered, he came to an engineering faculty meeting, and I was a junior member of the faculty, and he made a good talk, and I wasn't impressed very much one way or the other. He had lots of ideas that he liked to talk about. And then I think some of the faculty, the senior faculty, weren't too happy about him. They would have liked some of our other faculty, our current faculty at that time, to be promoted to the dean.
Were there any names in particular of people who might have been...
Well, Withy was one name that was mentioned. I don't know whether...
Okay, we're back to Johnson.
Yeah. Then the next time I met Johnson was after he had been appointed dean. And
president,
I presume, yes. We marched into the big auditorium in what's now Education Building. You go down the steps there. And at the first seat, there was a big, it was either a bushel of apples or a big box of apples. And we were to reach in and take an apple and sit down, which we thought was getting a little bit informal. Then he went on to tell us that he hoped that in a few years half of us would no longer be there, which, of course, was very well received. by the faculty. I think his idea was that he wanted to build a faculty or stimulate the faculty that he inherited to the point where they would be so outstanding that they would go to other schools and get better jobs out there. To give him the benefit of the doubt, maybe he had other ideas too, but that got him off on the wrong foot. My most intimate contact with him was. During the, I guess it was during those Depression years, one of his ideas was that he would make up a page for each, or have made up a page for each graduating senior with a student's picture on it and certain... bio data, and it was to be in a very specific form, which is nice. You can page through and make comparisons very nicely that way. But abbreviations were to be of a certain type, and the punctuations and abbreviations were to have periods and commas and semicolons were supposed to be in a certain place, and every page was supposed to be the same. Well, you know how students are. They don't come in that way. So one of my duties, I guess I must have been an instructor at that time, was to, invited me into his office in a big table there. And I would have these sheets, and I would go down the sheet and make the corrections so that they all ended up looking the same. While I was there, he would continue his ordinary conference schedule. Students would come in with the problems. He was just the, department chairman would come in and talk about various things. It was really kind of a queer thing for me to be sitting there, but it was very interesting. And I remember one time we weren't too busy, and he talked about the Christmas tree. Must have been about this time of the year, where the instructors were along the bottom of the tree and spread out, and then assistant professors, and they came up to the top with the dean up at the top, and they tried to impress upon me that there was only one dean, and I kind of got the idea I'd never get that high, and of course I didn't, but it was, I didn't know whether he was again urging me to look afield to find a better opportunity, a little higher up on the shorter branches, or what it was about. But he with his students, he liked to be kind of a father figure. And he would talk to them about anything. I can't remember specifically, but I think some come in and talk about girlfriends and all kinds of things.
What would you say the general perception of Dean Johnson by you and your colleagues in the civil engineering department was?
Well, I think... in general, most of us, at least at the lower levels, we lived with him, and we didn't have real strong feelings that we ought to get rid of him or anything of that sort. Again, this wasn't something that. Junior faculty talked about very much. Some of the senior faculty, though, were with in a group who really, I think, tried to get rid of.
How did he eventually leave? Or why did he leave?
I can't say specifically. I can't remember whether he retired or whether he, I don't think he went to another job. Maybe Ben or some of the others know better about that.
What, Dean Whitey?
Dean Withy?
Withy.
Yeah.
Replaced Dean Johnson.
Yeah.
Can you characterize him just briefly?
Withy, I knew, of course, as an undergraduate student. And he was a very approachable man. I remember going to him when I was graduating with my bachelor's degree and asking his advice about an opportunity. I was kind of interested in the highways field, and I thought maybe that I could get a job in that area someplace. And he rather encouraged me to look. Very approachable man. I remember going to him when I was graduating with my bachelor's degree, and asking his advice about an opportunity. I was kind of interested in the highways field, and I thought maybe that I could get a job in that area someplace. It would have been too bad, but I appreciated his frankness in that. I liked him very much. The rest of the faculty liked him. If there was any, I suppose there was, although I can't name specific names, that there were ambitions around the various departments, department chairman looking at the dean's job when Johnson was appointed. If there was any of that, when Withy was appointed, I think it had calmed down quite a bit. And I remember Professor Woodburn asking me about Withy, what I thought of him as a dean. And I said I thought that Withy would make a very good dean, as he did. And Woodburn said, if I make an appointment with you to see President Frigg, would you go up and talk to him and give him your opinion of Withy? And so I went up and had a nice little talk with the president. At that time, I guess it was almost the first time I was in the president.
What were Withy's strengths as a dean?
He was very stable. He worked for the college to get more funds, he was calm, but he was very energetic too. He did a fine job.
Did he have any weaknesses?
No. I really can't think of any.
He left to retire, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. And then he...
Yeah. I've forgotten whether whether retirement at 65 was mandatory at that time or not. I don't think it was. I think we could look up and who's who, how old he was when he retired. Yeah. I think he went on and that's right. And Wendt continued on very much in the Withy tradition. Wendt was Withy's right-hand man. He was associate dean as head of the engineering experiment station. And he did... Perhaps was more research-minded because of his experience than Withy, but Withy was research-minded too. He had built up that engineering mechanics laboratory in the old building, and then they moved it over to the new building, it was a very good laboratory for engineering mechanics or structural engineering research. This was a little bit different than in most schools. A structures laboratory generally at most schools at that time, and still, I guess, was in the civil engineering department rather than engineering mechanics. But engineering mechanics was the province of Professor Maurer, mm-hmm. Eddie Maurer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether he and Van Hagen didn't get along real well or not, but anyway, that was Maurer's laboratory. And Withy continued with the structures laboratory, and Bill Kinney was, I think, more interested in writing books and his teaching than in any laboratory. We didn't have any structures laboratory in the civil engineering department, continued on in the that tradition. We recently, very recently, have had the old highway laboratory across from the engineering building. It's a relatively new building, but the State Highway Commission moved their laboratory. We inherited part of that building. And we have some structures research now
at this point
in that area after all these years.
What was Kurt Wendt's major accomplishment, or what were his major accomplishments? Is there anything really?
Well, I think his he worked very well with industry. Kurt was very well liked by industry. I think it was Withy who started our engineering day, annual engineering day celebration when we honor half a dozen more or less distinguished engineers. Many of them alumni, but not limited to alumni. They must have some connection with the state of Wisconsin, you know, and University of Wisconsin.
So a lot of that industrial promotion relationship was an emphasis.
I think Wendt really furthered that, perhaps more than anybody else.
These two much more so than the first.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to look now at committee assignments, and I've made a list of the eight committees that you served on through 1959. The first one is the Regent Faculty Conference, Student Life and General Welfare, 37 and 38.
I attended one or possibly more of those conference committees. I don't remember too much about it. It was an opportunity for the faculty to talk with the regents, and of course the regents to talk with the faculty. But I don't remember too much about it.
What about lectures and convocations, 41, 42 through 45, 46?
We had a little money available for to bring lectures here from outside. And our primary function, I think, was to go over the list of applications and try to balance out different areas in the university in order to get the most distinguished scholars to come.
Would your decision be final?
I think, as I recall, the decision on allocation of funds was final. Now, a department could bring in somebody if they had their own funds.
This
was a university-wide thing. Right.
We talked about the divisional committees, physical sciences and math, 47, 48 earlier.
Right.
Is there anything else you want to add to that? Or?
I think not. I think we covered that.
Lake and stream investigations, 51, 52 through 58, 59. This, I don't know if the next three kind of go together.
They do. I'm not sure the underwater investigations, that may be a misprint. These were all groundwater. That might be surface water investigations. This was a developing area, and it developed into the memory isn't so good. Now, this Henry Hart operation.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to you about.
Political science.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Student personnel committee for, again, only 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that. The committee had, again, some funds for scholarships. As I recall, primarily undergraduate scholarships. And I know one of the things that we talked about had to do with recognizing scholarships, even though there was not financial need. It's highly desirable to give needy students scholarships when they have excellent scholastic records. But at the same time, we thought that those who really didn't need the money should also be recognized. And I don't know how that ever did end up. I think it probably was, again, one of these things that was talked about probably during the last year of my tenure on the committee.
And the Theodore
Herforth Award.
Award
I was on that for 1 year. We met with students who were nominated for the award. And if I remember correctly, Dean Bollinger was one of those students who got that award. We met at the Union and had a dinner meeting, and we each faculty member had a student sitting on each side. And we had a chance to talk, and of course there were two students across the table, too. And then that was for the whole appetizer, and then we would change places for the main course, and then we would change places again for the dessert course, and so that way we got to know almost 12 students that way, with a chance to talk and hear them talk. And, it was very, very interesting assignment. Mm-hmm.
Does the, we're done with the list of committees.
Yeah.
Does the phrase science inquiry mean anything to you?
Yeah, but I can't say offhand just what.
Started in the
30s,
I believe.
No, did the science inquiry get out a series of little green covered books? Hardly books, but
What it is, I bumped across it yesterday in an article from the Wisconsin Alumnus. It was a very big thing that was pushed. I think Frank started, or maybe E.B. Fred is dean of the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And there were several committees, of which you were on a couple. One is the Conservation of Natural Resources.
Yeah.
Quantity and mineral content.
Yeah.
With Thwaites, Dawson, Lenz, E.R. Jones, and Bean.
And I wrote Dawson's part.
You wrote Dawson's part. And then you were on with surface waters and water power with Dawson, Mead, Glazer, and Lenz.
Well, maybe that's the one. That
okay.
That's the little book. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that? How did that start?
I don't know exactly how it started. It was an attempt to bring to the people of the state and the nation, for that matter, information about the resources of Wisconsin and what the university was doing in these areas. And they got out several of these nice little books. I don't know whether I have one around yet or not, but I'm sure the library probably.
Was this more or less like a committee assignment?
We met a few times as a committee, I think probably one of the assignments was certain people were to write certain sections of each of these little books, and Dawson and I worked together on this one, and I guess I wrote most of it, and he probably edited it, and we got it together.
Were you ever a member of the university club?
Yeah, I was not only a member, I was on the board, I was secretary, and I was president.
When was that?
A little later.
60s?
In the 60s.
What?
One of the things, I'll tell you when it was. It was when they were talking about a high-rise building where Helen C. White, the towers. And we wanted the university club to be up on the top floor, top two floors, I guess. And you could look out all over the lake. And some of us thought it would be a great recruiting tool. And I was president of the university club committee at that time. The university club, I should say. And I worked hard for that. There But in order to operate something like that, we had to have an angel with lots of money. Or we had to have a compulsory membership. In my opinion, and the opinion of many on the university club board at that time, and we worked at it, and finally got it to the point. We took it up to was he president of the university? I guess so. At that time, it was just the Madison campus. What's his name? Who went to Michigan?
Fleming,
Robin Fleming. We went up, and he said, "Well, if you want to bring it up at the faculty meeting and have the compulsory membership," and someplace along the line, whether it was proposed, I think it must have been proposed through the university committee or somewhere. We talked to everybody we could think of who might help us. And there were objections for various reasons. One was the parking down in that area. But there was to be parking in the building, as there is in Helen White. And we thought, being across from the Union, people could come and have dinner at the University Club and then go across the street and go to the Union for concerts and plays and all kinds of things. But it finally ended up that the proposal would be, I remember presenting it at the faculty meeting, and the proposal would be that compulsory membership would be mandatory for new faculty members, but voluntary for current faculty members. Well, I didn't like that one bit. If the faculty didn't think enough about it to be willing to lay their own money on the line to operate it, then you can't ask new faculty members coming in to contribute. So it fell through. And we still have the university corporate. It's
why did you wait until so late in your career to join? Why didn't you join the university club earlier?
Well, there were several of us down at the laboratory. See, I was down at the laboratory then on the lakeshore. And the union was so handy that three or four of us would go over and have lunch in Trip Commons at noon. And we enjoyed that, and we had a chance to compare notes and chew the fat. So I didn't feel the need for the university committee, and I was still a fairly junior member, and to go over and sit at the table with Dean Ingram and various people. It just didn't seem to fit into my operations at that relatively early stage.
Did you ever belong to the dining club?
No.
One final quick area, and then we'll call it in. If you'd like to cooperate, we can go to there. Actually, I could ask for this too, but I'll ask you. Did you and or your spouse ever attend university athletic events?
Yes.
I can see by your sweatshirt with the Wisconsin Bucky Badger dribbling that you probably did.
I think from 1924 on.
Which ones?
I attended nearly, I'll say nearly, every football game that was played in Camp Randall Stadium up through this year. When I was in town, mm-hmm. that is, right. Of course, when I was out of town. And occasionally, especially in later years, when the weather gets too awfully bad, call it quits. But otherwise, I've attended practically all of the football games for some 60 years, more or less.
About basketball?
Basketball, yes. In the early days, of course, basketball was in the Red Gym. Mm-hmm. And as a student, I couldn't get to see more than one or two games. You know, we had student coupon books. And they had tickets for all athletic events. The athletic department, Elroy can tell you more about that. But we just go and tear out the appropriate coupon, and you could go to track, you could go to basketball, you could go to football. You know, they had a high ice hockey on the lower rink, on the lower campus, and an outdoor rink down there in the early days. Hal Roof was on the hockey team, I think, as an undergraduate. Basketball, football. While I was on the athletic board, we attended most all the track events in the over there at Camp Randall in the building, whatever they call it, the shell.
What about boxing?
Yes, we regularly attended the boxing matches. The ring was in the center of the floor, and there were folding chairs around the ring on the basketball floor. And then there were seats, somewhat cheaper seats, up on the side. And we usually got some of those seats on the side. You had to have some connection, I think, to get the reserve seats down to the bottom. Yeah.
Was there any interest in UW athletic teams on the part of your colleagues? Was it fairly common to talk about the football game?
The Wagners and the Crandalls and several of the others, especially from other departments, have that interest and have gone. The Woodburns, old Jim Woodburn, wouldn't miss a football game. And Ben still goes, you know.
Unless he's out of town.
Right.
Very sick.
I think he's seen more than I have, probably.
Characters, if you can, characterize your perception of the role of athletics in the life of the university.
Oh, I think athletics are very important in the life of the university. Our children are all UW graduates, and one is out in Lebanon Springs, New York, near Albany, and she and her family, her husband's a UW grad too. They are not so interested in athletics, and of course they're farther away, so that's part of that. But our daughter in Sheboygan and our son in Wanakee get a season ticket together, and we each go to about half the games, and I said, buy separate tickets and goes with friends, and he goes to hockey games. He has season tickets for Friday night hockey games, and he's gone to when Wisconsin was played in the finals for a national championship play, and he's gone on those trips.
Oh, that's
our daughter and her husband, our son, went down to the Independence Bowl a year ago and sat in the rain down there. So I think it's a big help to the university and a lot of enjoyment, too.
This is Barry Tanker of UW History Project. It's still December 14th, 1983, and I'm going to talk just briefly with Mrs. Lenz about her experiences as a faculty wife. We were talking before about the two different women's organizations within the College of Engineering that you were associated with. One is departmental and one is for the entire college. Let's start out with the departmental one.
Just civil engineering.
Yeah.
What was that? That would not mean, you don't mean Pentagon by that. That was the whole.
Pentagon was the whole
department. Okay. Well, this was just down in the latter years, more. And it wasn't in the beginning, but we had a group that would meet once a month. We would call it the Bridge Club, and all the members came. And in the beginning, it was very well attended, but as women got jobs, and we met in the evening.
What would you do with that?
We would have refreshments, and then we would, sometimes if we had, in the fall, we would all talk about what we had done during the summer, or we'd have some kind of a program, some kind of a reading, some kind of a reading.
One of the
members. Yes. Or we would have some outside speaker at times, and it was more social than education.
And what about, although it seemed to be both,
yes.
Speaker,
mm-hmm.
What about the Pentagon now? First of all, how did it get its name? And,
well, that Pentagon is from the five divisions in the School of Engineering.
Okay. And what did you do?
Well, that was purely social, really, except we'd have tea, and we would sometimes have music, often by children of the members. We have somebody singing, or we have a trio, violin, and cello, and something else. But it was mostly to get to know all the different members of the different divisions and departments in the school.
When you first joined that, was it rather intimidating?
Yes, it was very intimidating, because the year that I joined, there were just two of us new instructors, and the other people all seemed to know each other, and we clung together, and we had to, people sat around in a circle. It was done in the homes of the faculty, and a lot of the department heads had beautiful large homes in the Heights, and we'd go there, and one of the duties was to go around. You couldn't just slink into a chair and sort of disappear. You had to go all the way around the circle and shake hands with everybody. And it was sort of frightening for, you know, we were both young brides and married both on the same day, September 3rd, and here we came. But we felt that we just weren't, we were told that this was part of being the member, wife of the faculty member, that was our duty to attend these meetings. We did them at all costs. You just had to be almost dying.
So it was really an obligation.
It really was an obligation.
You didn't feel you had a choice.
No. And it was fun. It was, there were other young members too. We soon learned to, but most of them were a little older. But some, there were some around that age.
And again, it was mainly talk.
It mainly talk, and you would start by sitting out at a certain place, and some of the other members, I can always remember Mrs. Van Hagen saying the fruit basket upset, and then we'd have to move, because you shouldn't just be talking to one or two people. Mm-hmm. You should mix.
Oh, so it wasn't that you were standing and mixing, you were
No, we were
seated.
Sitting. It was all sitting.
All
yeah,
sitting. Oh,
and then we had to, and sometimes we would have, they would have sort of name tags in the shape of a leaf in the fall, and you'd have that pinned to you, and some of the leaves would be the same, and you were supposed to find your partner.
Clusters.
Yeah, there'd be five or so in a cluster. And it was very, it was, we just took that as our, it was always a, I can't remember now, I think about, there was a definite date for it. It was always the same. Maybe it was the second. It was the second Wednesday of the month.
Mm-hmm. What happened to that group over time? Did it continue?
It continued up until about 8 years ago, I think, or so, probably. And it dwindled finally because a lot of the women worked, and then some of the older ones who had been very staunch members, of course, were gone. Mm-hmm. And there were just a nucleus of dedicated people that came to it. And so it was, I was president of it when it was dying on the vine, and we really worked hard to keep it going. But we just
did the new faculty members' wives join?
No.
There wasn't any. When did that pressure or that obligation stop?
I'm trying to think how that stopped. I don't know. As these other women, for a long time, the same people were heads of their departments. That was just a sort of a thing. They were there for years, like Mrs. Bennett from Electrical Engineering, and Mrs. Withy, and Mrs. Van Hagen, and Mrs. Kinney, and different ones. And they Mrs. Ben Elliott's wife, Georgia Elliott, they put pressure on their people to come. And then after a while, as the department it was all changed, and those people sort of in electrical engineering. Then it got so big that we formed our own little groups of our own divisions, our own departments, because it was in electrical engineering. They had a luncheon once a month, and then we had this evening. And then in the early days, once a year we would have this great soiree at the Trip Commons, which was really a very lovely place in those days, and we'd have a dinner dance. A very nice meal.
Was it formal?
Yes, it was formal. And it was very nice. And it always had a good orchestra, and it was really quite fun. Mm. Pat Hyland of Mechanics, he was always one of the last ones on the floor. He loved to dance. And it was, you got to know the husbands that way. Otherwise, you didn't meet them very much.
So this was really an important socializing.
It was really,
yes.
Yes, it was.
Do you see anything with replacing that?
No.
So they're pretty much, unless they just happen to get together socially and they're pretty much left their chance.
And our department, the civil engineering department, really, we were quite different than some of the others. We kind of, we had a lot of parties of our own. My husband was first years. We would have Halloween parties at the Council Hydraulic Laboratory and keep us that social, but it was just our group.
Mm-hmm.
And the others sort of envied us because we really can't help that.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Changing from the athletic department, I want to talk about the arts in general here at the university. Did you and or your spouse attend many events in music hall?
Yes, I attended as many as I could. My husband had gotten very busy. He was on a lot of committees. He was also doing consulting work. So I had a very dear friend who loved the same thing that I did, music. And I can remember going to, we always like to sit up in the balcony, and you had to get up there early because acoustics were the best thing you could see. So we went there. We always free, you see, and most of them. And we attended as many as we could. And then the Union Theater was another great place. We went to all the plays. That and my husband.
To the Wisconsin Players?
Wisconsin Players. We were members for quite a few years.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Both?
Yes.
Were other members of the department members also?
Yes, I remember we went with two or three, and then, of course, the travel series. We went with about three other couples in our department, and that was fun. And then my son was an usher at the union, and my one daughter took passed out programs in the front, and so we went a lot. Mm-hmm. And then we were just a family sort of thing.
Ever see Harrisburg?
Yes, and my son-in-law was in Harrisburg. He was in charge of it.
Was that did you go frequently or just occasionally?
No, just when Ross, our son-in-law, was in the he was at the fraternity, and I think we only went 2 years, two or 3 years.
What were the different types of things you would see at the music hall?
Well, I'm trying to think. I know that we, there was, that was before, it was mostly orchestras and singing, and there wasn't much opera at that time. That came when Mulder came. It was mostly the orchestra played, and there were some very good solos. No, I mean local.
Oh, local.
Oh, yeah. Lucy Kelly was in there or something. She was singing with them because she was so attractive and a beautiful girl. And there were plays.
Yeah. Oh, there were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was very, particularly beautiful. And the stage was old. But it had something.
Yeah.
It atmosphere.
What about band concerts?
Oh, yes. We always went to the Tom Sunday band concert.
Where was that?
At the Union. Theater.
Oh,
yeah. And one time I got a record for being a 500 person. I think it was sort of staged. I got the record of the concert.
What about the Pro Arte Quartet?
We didn't go to.
Any dance concerts like orchestra?
Oh yeah, I was very interested in all that. Mm-hmm. Any ballet that. See, the Union Theater had a lot of more things now that the Civic Center has, and they had Coppelia and all different dance. And I'm very interested in the ballet.
And what about art galleries, art exhibits?
Yeah. I went to those with my friend.
So it would be fair to say, in summary, that you and your friend were the ones who went to most of the music symphony,
yes, mm-hmm,
art gallery types of things, mm-hmm, whereas your husband went to several of the plays.
Yes, he was more interested in
concerts.
Plays. Yeah.
No, not that much.
No,
okay.
No.
Okay. So. Okay, I think that's about what I want.
Okay.
Do you have anything that you'd like?
No, the only thing, I mean, that we're both interested in is athletics, that we...
Yeah, that's your mutual...
That's it. Well, he, I've gotten him so that he will listen to opera and ballet, and I don't impose it on him. It isn't going anymore, is it? No.
Yes, it is.
Oh,
that's okay. We're done.